From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's archive edition, we meet Sister Wendy Beckett. Her art history series on the BBC and PBS has made her an unlikely celebrity. But when she's not on TV, which is most of the time, she lives in a trailer on the grounds of a Carmelite monastery where she practices total silence. She has a new book for the holidays called Sister Wendy's Nativity. Also today, Frank Rich. His 13 years as drama critic for the New York Times earned him the nickname The Butcher of Broadway. A new collection of his writings has just been published. And Greed, Paranoia, and Distrust. Film critic John Powers reviews A Simple Plan. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The House Judiciary Committee begins debate today on four articles of impeachment against President Clinton. John Stempin reports.
Committee members finished opening statements this morning. Democrats warned the government's business would grind to a halt while the full House and Senate took up the issue, and that even the Supreme Court would be affected since the Chief Justice would preside over the trial in the Senate. But Republicans said the president was guilty of abusing power, and they did not undertake the process lightly. Judiciary Committee Chairman Henry Hyde asked rhetorically, "Who are we and who is the president? Is the president one of us or is he a sovereign?" According to Hyde, Mr. Clinton's conduct cheapens the oath to the truth, and that it was a breach of promise, and that it subverts the government. He dismissed the Democratic argument that Mr. Clinton's conduct was not impeachable as a so-what defense. Democrat Sheila Jackson Lee of Texas said charges that Mr. Clinton abused presidential powers were preposterous and urged her colleagues to instead vote for censure. White House spokesman Joe Lockhart said this morning the president was considering another round of contrition to possibly put off impeachment. The four articles accuse the president of lying under oath to a grand jury and in the Paula Jones civil suit, obstruction of justice and abuse of power, and working to conceal his relationship with Monica Lewinsky. For NPR News, I'm John Stempin in Washington.
United Nations weapons inspectors are working in Iraq today, but conflict continues to grow. Iraqi authorities are insisting that the UN teams will not be granted access to the ruling political party's main office. The chief UN weapons inspector, Richard Butler, says this is unacceptable. He has also told the UN Security Council that Iraqi authorities have also barred inspectors from taking pictures of bombs at a chemical monitoring site. Germany's highest court has ruled an alleged associate of Saudi millionaire Osama bin Laden can be extradited to the United States. The suspect is wanted in connection with the bombings of the U.S. embassies in Kenya and Tanzania. NPR's Edward Lifson reports.
When the 40-year-old Sudanese national Mamdouh Mahmoud Salem was arrested in Germany last September, he told German police that he knows bin Laden, but Salem denied any involvement in the attacks on the American compounds in Africa. Last month, a lower German court ruled that Salem could be extradited to the United States. He appealed. Today, Germany's highest court said that after a preliminary look at the case, it saw no reason to overturn the lower court's ruling. More than 260 people died and thousands were injured in last August's bomb attacks on the U.S. missions. U.S. officials accused Salem of conspiracy to murder and of weapons and explosives offenses. The suspect's lawyers claimed the U.S. charges against him are too vague to justify extradition. Now the government of German Chancellor Gerhard Schröder will have the final word on whether Salem will be extradited. Edward Lifson, NPR News, Berlin.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down more than 27 points at 8,814. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, the stock market fell more than 50 points after the opening bell this morning. This after yesterday's market decline of 1.9%. Markets have rallied somewhat today, NPR's Jack Spear reports.
Wall Street, after the market's big 167-point drop yesterday, is off its earlier session lows, but still has a ways to go as a sell-off extends into its fourth straight day today. The market remains lower, even with some positive economic news from the Commerce Department showing retail spending rose by a stronger-than-expected 0.6% last month. The government also announced today its producer price index, that's a measure of inflation at the wholesale level, fell 0.2% in November. One reason for the Dow's downward spiral was a big drop in Coca-Cola stock today. That followed a warning from the beverage giant that its fourth quarter earnings will be below Wall Street expectations. Coke announced, meanwhile, it is expanding overseas, buying some of Cadbury Schweppes brands in foreign countries for nearly $2 billion. Jack Spear, NPR News, Washington.
Japan is warning North Korea that Pyongyang will lose support for its multinational nuclear power plant unless Pyongyang eases fears about a suspected weapons program. Japan says the North Korean nuclear power program is meaningless if the North is really building a weapons program. Toy maker Hasbro has agreed to pay about $6 million to settle an antitrust lawsuit with 44 states. The states had sued the company over unfair sales practices. New York State's attorney general says Hasbro will pay nearly $2.5 million to the states, which will set up funds to benefit children. The company is to give the rest of the money in toys to a charity group this holiday season. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music, where imaginations can run wild. Over 200 locations nationwide. 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Terry Gross. Sister Wendy Beckett is a paradox. She's a nun who lives a life of seclusion and is also a quirky British TV star. Sister Wendy has been a member of the Notre Dame Teaching Order of Nuns since she was 16. She's now in her late 60s. In 1970, she was granted permission to leave teaching and live the contemplative life, devoting herself to prayer and study. She's since lived in a trailer on the grounds of a Carmelite monastery in England, where she spends each day in silence. We'll let her tell you how she became the star of a TV series on art history for the BBC. Sister Wendy has just published a new book called Sister Wendy's Nativity, in which she tells the story of Christ and features pictures of rare manuscripts from the Vatican and Italian state libraries. Her Story of Painting series still airs on PBS stations across the country. In this scene from the series, she's standing in front of Matisse's 1950 colored paper collage, Beasts of the Sea.
As you can see, two great cross sections through a lagoon. And he's filled them with seaweed and sea snails and fish, and all the fascinating, magical things that I'm told are under the sea. The layers of color. As one moves up through the sea, he makes one feel the joy of this, the wonderful floating sense of freedom as you go up and up and up. This painting, this cutout, gives us such exquisite pleasure that, though I hardly dare to say this, I don't think Matisse ever painted anything greater.
Terry spoke with Sister Wendy Beckett last year. She asked the sister if there's a connection between the life of silence she's chosen and her love of painting, a silent art form.
I think that's one of the things that attracted me to painting. The fact that it is something very compatible with my life of silence. I don't have music in my life. That's a sacrifice. But I do have literature, which is silent, and I have reproductions of paintings and of sculpture and of ceramics. And I think we can only really understand painting if we're prepared to give the time to contemplate it, to sit silently and look at the work. And so that also is very, very compatible with the kind of life I'm privileged to live.
What's your approach to looking at the work? Do you often just like sit in front of a reproduction for a long period of time and just gaze at it?
Well, I always have a postcard up on the little stand. And I have a poster on the wall. And yes, I do spend time looking, because it's that time, it's that space, it's that attention that art needs if it's to unfold. And I've frequently found that when I've looked at something and don't like it, if I look long enough, I will find out within me why this is considered a work of art. There's always something, and only looking will make it clear to one.
I think a lot of people would assume that because you are a nun that you connect especially with religious painting. Would that be true?
No, I connect with great painting. And great painting, by definition, is spiritual. And I think many people confuse spiritual and religious. religious art uses religious iconography, and it may use it very poorly. There are plenty of fairly dud Madonnas from the Middle Ages and the Renaissance. Spiritual art is something very much deeper, and it may use religious images or it may not. But whatever it is, it will take us beyond our own capacity into something visionary, and then return us to ourselves with a deeper sense of who we are and what life demands of us.
Now, what about art that would be considered blasphemous by some because of its content? I guess one example would be like a Piss Christ, in which there was a crucifix immersed in urine and then photographed.
Yes, I know, the Serrano.
Yeah, the Andre Serrano piece.
Yeah, I think people were rather quick to condemn that as blasphemous. He could have been making the perfectly valid point that that's what we actually do to the sacrifice of Christ. We have degraded it. We have not, as a human race, accepted with reverence and practical love what Jesus did. And you could say that all poor Serrano was trying to do was to make that point. Now, I don't like that kind of art. To me, that's very minor art. In an art form, that's what I call newspaper art. You get the point and then you pass on. No one would want to contemplate a Serrano very long.
So you don't like a lot of more conceptual contemporary art because once you got the message, there's no reason to go back to it?
I think it has a point, as newspapers have a point. But a newspaper isn't a great novel that one will read and reread again. And conceptual art is not something one will go back to. It has a brief flowering and then it's over. So no, this doesn't appeal to me very much, and I don't know any work of conceptual art that to me comes into the category of great art.
Now, what about the disparity between your cloistered spiritual life and the 30,000 miles of travel to 12 countries that were required of you to shoot the PBS series?
Well, this was something I felt it would be selfish not to do.
Mm-hmm.
Because for some strange reason, I've been given first the opportunity to read a great deal about art and to look at a great many images, and secondly, the kind of mind that can talk about these things with enthusiasm and simplicity. Now, I think there are millions of people who could do as well, but they haven't come out of the woodwork yet. And I implore people who are listening to this program, if they think that they can do better, and I am sure they can, please come and offer yourself to the television people.
You use the word simplicity, that you could do this with simplicity. What do you mean by that?
That people can understand me.
Mm-hmm.
I consider it a mark of cloudy thinking to use difficult words, or to suggest that anything is beyond the comprehension of your viewers or your listeners. One can explain anything, perhaps not the complexities of science, but when it comes to the arts, they're there for enjoyment. They're there for everybody. They're our birthright, and this should be made obvious to people. And because it seems that I have the good fortune to be able to do that, I think I would be very selfish if I was to say, but I don't want to do it. I want just to stay in my silence. I think I have to draw a line and say I can only do so much of it. You know, 2 weeks here and then 2 months back home and then another 2 weeks, etc. But I think that's a sacrifice that I'm called upon to make, because any gift any of us have is never just for us, it's for sharing.
Have you seen this as a sacrifice, or have you welcomed the opportunity to actually be in the world, see the world?
Oh, no, it's a sacrifice. I would be delighted if I could say hand over the task to somebody else. No, I would never have wanted to do this. And I sometimes look at the Lord with a rather quizzical air. You know, I was so lucky. I had all that wonderful solitude and silence. And then he asks me to give up parts of it. Well, if I really want to love and serve him, then I must try and do this with as big a smile as I can manage. But it would never have been my choice.
Now, have you ever watched television?
Well, of course, we haven't got a television, and I wouldn't want to watch television. But when I'm in the hotel filming, then I have seen some television.
But until you were actually shooting the series, The Story of Painting, did you see TV before you?
Well, That's not my first series.
Okay, true. Okay, before you started doing series for the BBC. Yes.
No, I had not seen television.
So the first time you really saw television was when you were making it yourself.
Well, I don't like watching myself either. But this, I suppose, was helpful in that I didn't really know what I was agreeing to do.
So you didn't know what any of the kind of general wisdom is about TV or what any of the rules and assumptions are?
No.
Uh-huh.
I didn't know what was involved. So I just went... It seemed to me they were suggesting I should do something that was going to be useful for people. And I thought, well, why not?
Well, let me ask you this. I know you don't have a mirror and you don't gaze at yourself in mirrors. What was it like to see yourself on TV? I mean, did you even know what you looked like?
It is deeply humiliating if you look like me. I've seen a picture of you, and for you it might be quite nice to see yourself on television. But when you have a great fat face and protruding teeth and large glasses. It's very good for the soul, very purifying to see how deeply unattractive one is.
So you almost see it as penance when you see yourself on TV.
Yes, it's hard to take. It's bad for my vanity. See, when you don't see yourself, you can think you're more... elegant looking than you actually are, and then you have your nose rubbed into it.
Were you self-conscious as a girl, and did self-consciousness have to do with you becoming a nun at all?
No, I don't think I was self-conscious. I've always known I was plain, but it doesn't matter very much. It doesn't matter very much for television either. I think it's an encouragement to people to see that I'm plain, because this is not some dazzling beauty which makes them special, as beauty always does, telling people about art. This is somebody who looks just like their old Aunt Agatha.
Well, you know, you are one of the rare people who is allowed on TV without being beautiful. you know, TV is very, very kind of exclusive in that respect.
Yes, and it's dangerous, you see, because it makes the ordinary people feel that what happens on television is in this kind of fairy world. It doesn't affect them.
Right.
And I want art to come into their lives and affect them. So I think God did well in not giving me the dangerous gift of beauty.
My guest is Sister Wendy Beckett. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Sister Wendy Beckett. When you decided to say yes to the BBC offer a few years ago, when you first started working with the network, did you have to justify it to your religious order, or did they encourage you to accept the offer of the BBC?
Well, I'm in a rather unusual position as a nun. I'm a consecrated virgin, and I live under the protection of the Carmelites, but I am not a Carmelite. But they act as if they were my order. So, of course, I can't do anything without discussing it with the Reverend Mother, Rachel, who's a great friend of mine. And she's always been completely trusting. She says, Wendy, if you think it's a good thing to do, go ahead. Now, that was how they greeted the idea of the first series. And then the BBC, bless them, came down with the television and the tapes to show the sisters. And since then, they've been very keen on the idea because they could see what it was offering to people. So my sisters, to whom I don't talk, but whom I love very much, they are sorry for me, but certain in their own minds that this is something that I'm still called upon to do.
They're sorry for you.
Well, yes, to have to leave silence.
Mm-hmm.
Very sorry for me. Grateful that God hasn't asked it of them. And, of course, he couldn't, because as Carmelites, they are strictly enclosed. They couldn't do it. And I wish, sort of, God had had the forethought for me to become a Carmelite, that I wouldn't be able to do it either. But I'm in this no man's land, you see, where I can accept the offer if it seems right to me, and it did seem right.
Well, just to explain, you had joined a teaching order, the Order of Notre Dame.
Yes.
And then asked for a life of seclusion, and you're living now on the premises of a Carmelite.
That's right.
Order. So that's why you're in the middle of two worlds. But
yes.
Really, the order that you're a part of is a teaching order, not the Carmelite order.
And so, my first order, my only order, the Sisters of Notre Dame de Namur, have been also very supportive and and enthusiastic. They also know how painful it is for me not to have the total uninterrupted contemplation that I had for 27 years. But it won't last, you see, this television. And now that I'm aging, I can perhaps see release in sight.
Is that how you think of it, release?
Yes, it will be a release.
You know, I think many people find it hard to understand why someone would opt for a life of seclusion and silence. For example, silence and seclusion, silence and isolation are often methods for punishing people. You know, we think of that as a hardship.
Remember, it means for me, I'm alone with God. And this is something I've longed for from babyhood, to be able to spend my life with God shining on me, to be spread out before him and for God to take possession of me. So it's a tremendous joy and privilege for me to be given this. And in fact, I feel I've won one of the very great prizes. I can't think of anybody in the world who is more fortunate than I am.
I think, in a way, it's especially surprising that you would choose a life of silence, because you're clearly so verbal, so articulate.
Yes, but I am articulate. And talking, as you can see, comes easy to me, but it's not what I would choose to do. I call it bouncing the ball. And I can do it for a bit, and then I simply cannot do it anymore. Partly because I think when I do talk, I talk with all my energy. So if I could only kind of do it half flow, I might be able to do more of it. But I'm not a constantly flowing stream. I can flow with great energy, and then it dries up. I just long passionately and in a kind of hungry, needy way to be back in solitude, which I suppose indicates that I'm a rather inadequate sort of person, but that's true of me, and I have to live, as we all have to, within the parameters of what we are.
Now, you've said that you've never known doubt. I can't imagine what that feels like, to have never known doubt.
Well, I can't imagine what it feels like to doubt. But I will say this, Terry, that whenever I'm talking to people about religious things, I'm able to throw myself into into what it's like for them. And a lot of the things I say are not things I know for myself, because I don't feel that. But I know other people do. And I make an imaginative leap into what life is like spiritually for most people. I, for some reason, was not strong enough as a person to be able to bear the burdens and the temptations that most people have and grow closer to God by coping with. I have been exempt from that, obviously, because you could see I wouldn't be able to manage. So it's not a... It's not because I'm good, it's because I'm not good that I think I've always had this complete certainty about God. The only certainty, I could doubt anything else, but that God is, and that God is total love. No, that I've never doubted.
You once said, I'm like a singer with perfect pitch, only what I was given was an abiding and constant sense of what God is. I'm wondering if your parents were religious.
They were religious, but not in any sense a kind of pious way. But it was quite clear to me that God mattered to them. They would never have missed Sunday Mass, for example.
Mm-hmm.
But there wasn't a lot of rosary saying in the house. It was a very happy house because my parents were such loving people. And I didn't realize that grown-ups ever quarreled or raised their voice or said spiteful things. I thought that was just children, because neither of my parents, I think, knew what malice was. So I was very lucky.
Were your parents pleased when you told them that you felt that you were called?
Well, I never had to tell them.
They just knew?
Well, it was taken for granted in the family because I hadn't been certain since I was a very small child. If I told them when I was 3 or something, I don't remember it. But it was taken for granted, and I can remember my mother sort of shaking her head one day and saying, "It makes me so cross, Wendy. You're going to be a nun and everyone will think what a saint you are, and only I will know what a difficult child you have been."
Sister Wendy Beckett's new book is Sister Wendy's Nativity. Her TV series airs on many PBS stations. We'll hear more of Terry's interview with her in the second half of our show. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, former New York Times drama critic Frank Rich. His new collection of past reviews and essays is called Hot Seat. Also, film critic John Powers reviews A Simple Plan. And we continue our interview with Sister Wendy Beckett. This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Terry Gross, and we're back with Sister Wendy Beckett. She's a nun who lives a life of silence, study, and prayer. Occasionally, she breaks her silence to host a BBC TV series on art history, which also airs on PBS stations nationwide. Sister Wendy has a new book for Christmas about the life of Christ as told in art. It's called Sister Wendy's Nativity. Terry spoke with her last year about her paradoxical life.
Now, I know that a good deal of the time that you've been studying art, you've been doing it in seclusion in your trailer, so you've been looking at reproductions, at posters and postcards and pictures. When did you actually get to a museum?
When I wrote my first book, which was Contemporary Women Artists, the publishers, which were Fiden, the great art publishers, asked me if I would mind if they took me to look at one work that I'd written about, just to see if it would change my opinion. And they did. And I said, that's exactly what I thought it was like. And I don't need to look at any of the others. So I suppose that was the first time. I have been to a few exhibitions when I've been out working for the BBC. I don't go to contemporary exhibitions anymore, but I've been to some old masters, and I'm usually allowed to go in when it's closed to the public. But, you know, when you go into a museum, ideal though it is in many ways, you've got to walk around, and there are all those other works calling for attention. There's something very pleasant about sitting in your own space with your card up and silence and time.
So you feel that you can get everything from a postcard reproduction of a painting that you could get from being in front of the painting itself?
You can get a lot. You have to read up about the artist to make certain you're imagining the texture right. For example, Rembrandt has often very thick, lumpy paint. And you need to know that when you're looking at the work. And you must know what the dimensions are so that you can imagine it right. But with all that, yes, you can get very close. And I think this should be a great comfort to all the people who know they can't get to museums. People tend to think, I can't get to any of the world's great museums or even to a small museum, so art must be a closed book to me. No, they're wrong. You can get enormously close if you're prepared to take the trouble.
What was it like for you to go to the Sistine Chapel? And I'm thinking in part, you know, of the great painting there, but I'm also thinking of what it's like for you to go from this life of denial, living in a trailer, to being in this, you know, just beautiful and ornate.
But it all seems very unreal.
Mm-hmm.
And I enjoy it more when it's over and I'm back home again and I can think back on it, if that makes sense to you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sightseeing is terrible, but having sightseen is wonderful.
Well, I'm wondering if you find that approach to a place of prayer beautiful or ostentatious.
Well, it's only technically now a place of prayer. My ideal place of prayer has nothing in it.
Mm-hmm. I think some of your viewers over the years have been surprised that you're not prudish around paintings of nudes.
Well, remember, I'm a Catholic, I'm a Christian, which means we know that God made the body. And I've been baffled by the sense that some people feel the body's a kind of no-no, and certain areas of the body, God clearly made a terrible mistake, and we should try and hide his ignominy from other people.
Well, I think it's also that a lot of people assume that the church is uncomfortable about nude portrayals of the body. And in fact, I think parts of the church have been very, very reactionary about certain art and art exhibitions.
Well, the church's business is the church, isn't it? It wouldn't be appropriate to have nude females draped all around the interior of a church. And if any church was to say they really would rather not have these paintings, I think they would be absolutely right. Everything in its rightful place. And the naked body is sometimes the only way an artist can portray his meaning. When it isn't, it's not artistically right.
I think TV really changes people's egos. I think it's easier to get a really big ego if you're, you know, doing on TV and watched by a lot of people and so on. And your life of prayer is about, like, losing ego. I mean, that's in part what it's about.
Yes.
Do you ever get a sense of conflict between the way that television builds ego and your desire to lose ego? Or is that not affecting you at all?
I would say television is a very purifying medium. You're perpetually exposed to your inadequacies. No, I think I've learnt a lot about what a poor lover of God I am through working on television. It has certainly made me long much more passionately to be purified than I think if I hadn't had this exposure.
Well, let me stop you. You say it's taught you that you're a poor lover of God. I could see you see yourself on TV and it's taught you that you have thick eyeglasses or you have a space between your teeth or something. But what do you mean by that it's taught you you're a poor lover of God?
Yes, because I get impatient with what they do. I get angry, which I never get, of course, in the caravan, you see. So I didn't really know I had a capacity for anger.
I see.
And that having to cope with an emotion I was quite unused to was very good for me.
Let me say before we have to wrap up the interview that I really appreciate your talking, and I feel like it must be... I don't know what your attitude is towards interviews, whether you see it as very intrusive to have to... not only talk, but have to explain your life of not talking. It's a very strange predicament to be in an interview like this for someone like you.
Well, if it doesn't hurt your feelings, Terry, no one could want to be interviewed, I think. but
I completely understand what you're saying, believe it or not.
But it's, again, if... people have spent money making these programs, publishing these books. You owe it to them to try and make the thing a success. Also, I mean, the fact that I've done it means that I think it matters that people should see this art. And if this is going to help, well, why hold back and say, well, I've done enough? Press on. One day I'll fall dead at an interview and then I'll feel I've given the whole lot.
Well, I thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, dear Terry.
And I really wish you the best.
Thank you.
Sister Wendy Beckett. Her new book is Sister Wendy's Nativity. Her BBC Art History series airs on many PBS stations. Coming up, former theater critic Frank Rich. This is Fresh Air. Frank Rich doesn't think he quite earned the nickname the Butcher of Broadway, but his reviews were said to have had the power to make or break a show. For 13 years, he was the chief theater critic for the New York Times. 4 years ago, he left the theater beat to write an op-ed column, which appears twice weekly in the Times. A new collection of his theater reviews has just been published. It's called Hot Seat, Theater Criticism for the New York Times, 1980 to 1993. It includes reviews of the big hits from that period, such as Angels in America and M. Butterfly. The book also features essays about the toll AIDS has taken on Broadway and Rich's tributes to the prominent critics Kenneth Tynan and Walter Kerr. Terry spoke with Frank Rich in 1994.
The assumption was during the years that you were the first-string critic that you could either kill a show or make it into a huge success. And I'm wondering how true you think that was and whether the thought of that possibility would weigh on you as you were writing your review or if that's something you tried not to think about.
Well, first of all, it's part of the mythology of the job. And it was true before I was a Times drama critic. It was true when there were seven newspapers in New York. When I was a kid, Times drama critic is always considered to have this make-or-break power. It's extremely exaggerated. Of course, occasionally a Times review can make a big difference, pro or con. And there were a couple of examples, but not many during my 13 years. But usually, the shows that are the big hits in New York, that reflects a consensus of opinion. People could say, oh, the New York Times, Frank Rich made Guys and Dolls a hit, or made Tommy a hit, or Angels in America a hit. In fact, they got unanimously favorable reviews, or close to it, from all the major newspapers and magazines. So why would the Times be entirely responsible? And the same thing's true with the flops. However, in doing the job, to answer your second question, I always tuned it out because, frankly, as a journalist, that was none of my business. My business was to tell the reader as honestly as I could what I felt about something, and that's who I had in mind. The reader, who might have to spend $50 or $100 to see one of these plays and spend an evening there, my heart was with the reader.
When you were reviewing theater, were you self-conscious about that moment when you'd walk into the theater and walk down the aisle and people were probably turning to each other and saying, it's Frank Rich, the Times theater critic?
Not terribly. First of all, I don't think I was so recognized until maybe the last couple of years when I started to be more on TV and stuff like that. But I learned to tune it out. It wasn't part of my job. Even when I was fairly unknown, I always knew that the people were planted around me to scream and yell in my ear and say things like, gosh, isn't that the greatest performance you've ever seen in your life? You know, 1 minute after it began.
Were they really planted there?
They really were planted there. I'll never forget taking one of my two sons, who was then quite young, he probably was 9 or 10 years old, to an incredibly dreadful murder mystery that shall remain nameless. It was the first time he came with me when I was reviewing something, and we went to a matinee, and it was supposed to be this funny murder mystery, and it was completely unfunny, and also you could figure out who did it about 15 minutes into the show. Well, behind us, there are a couple of men, I'd say, in their early 60s, who are just slapping their legs and screaming with laughter at every silly line. And afterwards, as we're leaving the theater, my son turns to me, and he was this little kid, he says, Dad, what was going on? Why were those people laughing so much? And I said, well, they were planted there by the management. They're trying to influence the opinion of critics like me. And he said, but Dad, they were grown-ups. I can't believe they did that. So that kind of stuff goes on all the time. And you learn to tune it out. Similarly, there's a converse to that, which is that sometimes through happenstance, a show postponing its opening several times in such a way that they're letting the critics in at a date they hadn't originally planned on, and the audience, unfortunately for them, in their view, is filled with real people who are not necessarily part of a claque, that audience can be very hostile to a show that you find yourself liking. And you've got to fight the impulse to be influenced by that, too. A classic example is a show where I feel I did make a difference, Stephen Sondheim's Sunday in the Park with George. That show postponed so often, by the time the critics went, they had no choice but to let us go on a theater party night where the audience was very jaded, somewhat elderly, very suburban. It's a very daring show, and there were lots of walkouts and lots of hostile response and tepid response. And yet I was sitting there crying. I was so moved by the show. And so I had learned to tune out that, just as I learned to tune out the false cheers of shows that were not so good.
The producer, David Merrick, was alleged to have said about you, Mr. Rich made many contributions to the American theater, none more great than to leave his post as theater critic. what was between you and David Merrick that would lead him to say such a thing, or to at least have been reputed to say such a thing?
Not much, really. The absence of people like David Merrick is really one thing that's hurt the theater very badly. I'm a David Merrick fan. I grew up in his heyday, which had passed really by the time I became a drama critic. There were only a couple of shows that he did during the 13 years I was there. He always had vendettas against the New York Times drama critic, and he would use them to sell his shows. And this was less the case when I was critic, but it was brilliant when I was growing up. You know, he did famous stunts such as take out ads with fake quotes by critics who had the same names as the New York Times drama critics. He baited one of my predecessors by attacking him on the Johnny Carson show for a half hour. Another one, he had distributed his Christmas gift, a supposedly pornographic novel that this critic had written as a young man and was thought to have vanished from the face of the earth. Merrick found every copy, like in a Paris bookstore, and gave it to the entire New York press corps. He was a great showman, and the truth is that I didn't know him, and my fondest memories of him are as a teenager. I took tickets for a lot of his shows, and I thought that was the theater, what the Broadway theater should be. Not that he couldn't be a jerk, and he was, you know, a mean guy, I'm sure, but nonetheless, he did incredible stuff, from, you know, Look Back in Anger and Marat Sade at one extreme to Gypsy and Hello, Dolly at the other. I only had him in the tail end of career, and he said that about me because I'm sure I didn't like 42nd Street enough, which is one of the first shows I reviewed and one of the last shows, sadly, that he produced.
There were a couple of almost legendary feuds that you got in during the years that you were a theater critic. Without really going into them, I'll say that the things that were said about you include that that there was a personal nastiness sometimes behind what you wrote. And another comment was that you had strongly influenced not only the aesthetic direction of theater, but the artistic personnel, the style and content of American theater. How would you respond to both of those things? We'll start first with personal nastiness.
The first thing is easy. I'm not saying that I couldn't be tough, and I could certainly be a very tart writer. I hope I was. But there was nothing personal going on because I didn't know the people I was reviewing. One of the things that's important to the Times about any of its drama critics or critics in general is that we don't know the people we're reviewing. I didn't go to the Tony Awards. I didn't know David Merrick personally or someone, say, like David Hare, to give an example of someone who took a strong exception to what I wrote about some of his work, although I liked a lot of it. I didn't know David Hare. So, I don't know, I think that's what's always said about bad reviews, no matter who writes them. As far as influencing artistic trends in the theater, I think artists are very independent people and good artists don't write what critics or journalists or anyone, or their parents or their spouses or their loved ones tell them to write. I do feel, and I'm proud of the fact, that I champion certain kinds of theater while I was a drama critic. I had a very strong point of view, and, you know, I'm very much stand behind it. And it is true that probably because I extravagantly praised Tony Kushner's Angels in America, to take a handy and recent example, when it was being done in a very small theater, a very small stage, the National Theater in London, it probably did influence the decision of Broadway producers to take a chance on it and bring it to New York at no doubt huge cost, given the length and kind of play it is. Yet, I'm fine about that. I think that art like that needs advocacy, and frankly, I think that if I was the only one who felt that way about Angels in America, it would have failed. And it hasn't failed because obviously it rings a chord with a lot of people. And there are other things I didn't champion. I was not a fan of the musicals of Andrew Lloyd Webber. And
Well, you had a lot of influence there.
I had exactly zero influence, exactly. But, you know, but here's an example of someone who every time I knocked one of his shows, and I didn't knock all of them, and I didn't knock them uniformly, would give out an interview and saying it was a personal attack on him or whatever. I've never met Andrew Lloyd Webber. I just know what I see and hear. And I also, again, as you said, I had no effect there. That's fine, too. I think that the public has to be given credit for knowing its own mind. And if people want Phantom of the Opera, they're going to find it, and they're going to embrace it, even if the New York Times critic doesn't like it.
Frank Rich spoke with Terry Gross in 1994. His new collection of reviews and essays is called Hot Seat. Coming up, a review of the film A Simple Plan. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. A Simple Plan is a new suspense film by Sam Raimi, who's best known for such horror movies as The Evil Dead. John Powers has this review.
American movies have become so routinely brutal that I get faintly depressed each time I hear about a new crime picture, which is one reason I was so unexpectedly moved by A Simple Plan, a beautiful new thriller which owes more to the Old Testament than to pulp fiction. Bill Paxton stars as Hank Mitchell, a decent man with a loving wife, Sarah, played by Bridget Fonda, neighbors who respect him, and a steady job at the local feed store. But all that changes when Hank, his brother Jacob, that's Billy Bob Thornton, and Jacob's Yahoo buddy Lou stumble across a small, snow-covered airplane containing one dead pilot and $4 million. Thinking it dirty money, they decide to keep the cash, little realizing they're opening Pandora's plane. Within minutes, they've entered a nightmare of galloping paranoias, shifting loyalties, and seemingly necessary murders. Greed doesn't merely corrode the trio's moral sense. It salts old wounds, the resentments, failed dreams, and long-buried rivalries that were uncovered along with the snow-encrusted plane. A Simple Plan was written by Scott Smith, whose original bestseller was a terrific piece of pulp. His script is even better. In cutting his tail to fit the demands of the screen, he's created a story that's leaner and more powerful than his book. The twists keep coming with clockwork precision, but we never lose sight of the character's complexity, be it the financial desperation of the loutish Lou, or Sarah's horror when Hank decides they shouldn't keep the money after all.
I've got a plan. I'm taking the money back right now, all of it.
Hank.
No.
Hank.
I'm going to put it back, and everything's going to be just like it used to be.
Is that what you think? Is that what you think you want? Walking off to the feed store every morning for the next 30 years waiting for Tom Butler to retire or die so you can finally get a raise? What about Amanda? You think she's gonna like growing up in somebody else's hand-me-down clothes? Playing with some kid's old toys because we can never afford to buy her anything new?
Don't say anymore.
And me? What about me?
Even as Fonda gives the best performance of her career, the movie is carried by Bill Paxton, an actor routinely cast as good old boys or sleazoids in pictures like True Lies and Twister. But he's at his best in movies like One False Move and this one, where he plays ordinary men who must confront confusion and pain and their own fatal weakness. Hank's desire not to get caught makes him a scheming menace, yet he's genuinely burdened by others' unhappiness. He's never been more heartbreaking than when he finally grasps just how lonely and empty his brother's life really is. Jacob isn't just a millstone, but a lost soul. Although Thornton's Jacob looks like a derelict auditioning to play Garth in Wayne's World, he comes bedecked in nerdy glasses and goofy long hair, his performance rises to moments of genuine greatness. He's thrillingly good in the movie's best scene, when Jacob must choose between his closest friend Lou and the brother who's always found him an embarrassment. The movie marks the artistic maturation of Sam Raimi, the 38-year-old director best known for cartoonish, half-good pictures like The Evil Dead and that silly Sharon Stone western, The Quick and the Dead. For the first time ever, Raimi doesn't sacrifice everything to jokes and eye-popping visuals. A Simple Plan is a film of enormous delicacy and restraint. Using snowy landscapes and a muted palette, Raimi fills his serpentine plot with compassion for human frailty, making us feel the stifling smallness of life in a declining Midwestern town. We agonize as the characters keep taking wrong steps that only compromise them more deeply. And we feel the biblical resonances of a story that finally hinges on the tortured relationship of two brothers. Most neo-noirs are simply an excuse for hip wisecracks and jocular cruelty. But here, Sam Raimi recaptures the human dimension of theft and murder. In this film, crime has an emotional weight that crumples some characters, brings out self-protective violence in others, and reveals the wide vein of sadness that runs through daily life. Moody, intricate, and quietly devastating, A Simple Plan tells us that nothing human can ever be simple.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue.
Thank you.
Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our show was produced today by Roberta Shorrock with Kathy Wolf. Our engineers this week are Al Banks, Audrey Bentham, Chris Fraley, and Fred Snyder. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave.